Welcome to the Filmed Live Musicals Podcast, a podcast about stage musicals that have been legally filmed and publicly distributed. The Filmed Live Musicals website contains information on nearly 200 musicals that have been captured live. Check it out at filmedlivemusicals.com. And now, on with the show. Welcome to episode 38 of the Filmed Live Musicals podcast and part three of our three-part special celebrating Stephen Sondheim. I'm your host, Louisa Lyons, and I'm once again joined by the brilliant Margaret Hall, musical theater historian and author of the upcoming book, Geminiani, Life and Lessons from Broadway and Beyond. Today, we are discussing the musical that inspired the creation of Filmed Live Musicals, the 2011 New York Philharmonic production of Company. In 2012, I was studying at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama and saw an encore cinema screening of Company at the Odeon Cinema. And in a pre-taped interview before the screening, producer Ellen M. Krass stated that she'd had trouble getting funding for filming a live musical because no one had heard of such a thing. And I sat up in my seat and I said, "Wait, what?" Because I had grown up watching Into the Woods on VHS. And I immediately the next day went and changed my thesis and wrote about the history of Filmed Live Musicals. And here we are 10 years later. Filmed Live Musicals is now a website with a weekly newsletter and this very podcast. And I'm very, 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 very excited to be diving into this production with Margaret. Welcome, Margaret.
Hello, hello.
So lovely to have you back.
Wonderful to be here.
To start us off, where was Sondheim, just as a refresher, where was Sondheim in his career when he and George Firth wrote Company?
So Company is the turning point show for Sondheim. This is, in my opinion, the first Sondheim show with a capital S underlined, italicized. Before Company, he's still sort of finding his rhythm, figuring out who he is as an artist. And Company is when he really finds that special place inside him that made him unlike anyone else in the business. He was in his 30s and having certain feelings about things that come with that age. And he decided to take on a task that he had basically set for himself at the age of 16. Which was to fix Oscar Hammerstein II's Allegro, which is the first show that Steve had ever worked on. He was Oscar's gopher. For those of you who aren't familiar with Allegro, it's essentially the genesis of what is commonly referred to as a concept musical. You can't see Louisa, but she's laughing because she knows that I hate the term concept musical. Every musical has a concept. It's a synonym for idea. But what was special about Allegro is that it wasn't necessarily a show about plot, but a show just about that specific idea. And in the case of Company, that idea is the concept of marriage and approaching what marriage means from every angle. And how Prince teamed up with Stephen Sondheim to bring this to life, and George Firth gave him the scaffolding with which to present one of the most incredible scores of the 1970s, and it came out at the beginning of the decade, so people had a lot of legway to catch up with him.
And my understanding is that George Firth had already written, he'd written seven short plays that were scheduled to be produced, and then it didn't happen, and he gave it to Sondheim. He gave the plays to Sondheim, like, what can I do with this? And Sondheim passed it on to Hal Prince, and Hal Prince said, turn it into a musical, to which George Firth and Sondheim said, this can't be a musical, therefore we must make it into a musical.
Yes, this can't be a musical in the way a musical is expected to be, so we're going to change what a musical is to make it fit this.
Mm-hmm. And I think as we, when we get into the show a little bit more, the fact that it was pre-written, that the characters were very established and lived in their own worlds before it was a musical is really evident because the book of this show is so strong.
Mm. It's also interesting because, and I believe this is partially because of the fact these characters were written before, but also because of how Steve was working at this point in his life, the characters are very archetypal and they don't really interact with each other very much, if at all. Pretty much Joanne is the only character that pops in and out of the other characters' vignettes. We never really get a scene where, like, Susan and Jenny are hanging out. That's just not a thing. And so there's this interesting thing that's happened with Company where it's incredibly malleable when revived and reworked because there's so much like space. It's like a postmodernist painting that utilizes negative space, only it's a postmodernist musical. We don't know how Bobby knows any of these people. Outside of Joanne, there's not really any prescribed ages. Or, okay, Bobby has to be 35, believably. 35. But, like, the other couples can be any which way. Mm. And it's part of why I think the current revival that's playing on Broadway right now works, is you can flip the genders when the characters are not that hyper-specifically dynamic in that way. The characters lend themselves to open interpretation in the same way that a lot of old school Aristotelian drama lends itself to that sort of open interpretation. And I think it's a really interesting thing that's achieved between George Firth and Steve Sondheim on this, because a lot of the music, it really works well as standalones. In a lot of ways, Company to me feels like seven plays and a bunch of songs that were surprisingly married together. They don't lead in and out of each other in the same way that, like, Some Enchanted Evening in South Pacific has to come after that scene. Mm. Marry Me a Little works just as well on a cabaret as it does in the show, although it's a lot happier in a cabaret setting, typically. But that's intent of performer. You can play with that.
And I think it's interesting that Sondheim says in his book, Finishing the Hat, that the way he approached it was kind of Brechtian, that it was meant to be a little jarring or standalone and separate from, like you say, it's not a traditional book musical where when you can't speak anymore, you break into song. They are separate and yet they come together and form this beautiful marriage that forms the entire show.
And it was interesting what different ways you can commute.
And what you were saying about the show being malleable, as you were saying that, it occurred to me, I think that this is the most revived Sondheim musical.
It's, I mean, if you take out the lyricist shows, yes. I believe
the which shows, sorry?
The lyricist shows, West Side Story and Gypsy.
Oh, yes. But for shows that he did book and, yeah. Sorry, lyrics
the,
and
the
music.
The Sondheim with a capital S shows.
Yes.
I think that's correct. If we take like the New York Philharmonic revivals, which some people count as revivals, but it's like a 1 week engagement that happened in like the 80s. If we take that out, I think Company is the most revived. And it certainly was the one that kickstarted a huge trend of revivals starting in the 1990s.
And so let's speed ahead to the New York Philharmonic production, because there's a lot to say about it. Do you have a sense of why the New York Philharmonic chose this particular show for this special gala?
Haha, do I ever? So, dear listener, if you've watched this recording of Company, you may notice the first person who walks on stage in the recording, who gets a great big ovation, is a man by the name of Paul Gimignani, which, as was mentioned in my intro, I know a bit about.
You literally wrote the book.
And Company is a show that always was important to Paul. That is the first Sondheim show he encountered in cast recording form, and he had never been able to do it. Up to 2010, Paul had done every single Sondheim show except for Company and A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. And he desperately wanted to get these two checked off. Desperately is not quite the right word, but those were like the two things on his bucket list. He doesn't typically go looking for productions, but he was looking for those two, and he was looking for a revival of Funny Girl. Those were the three scores he wanted to play on Broadway. He also happens to be very good friends with director Lonnie Price, who at this point is probably Paul's closest friend. They're like family. They've known each other for years, and Lonnie's a director at this point. And while I can neither confirm nor deny where this came from, based on my knowledge of people's character and also just what was happening in the 2010s with this crew, my guess is Lonnie came to Paul and said, "What do you want to do?" And Paul said, "These are my three shows." And Company was the one that the Philharmonic was willing to do. That's my guess, because that's typically how a lot of this stuff goes. When you're putting together a gala like this, you shortlist a bunch of stuff, you figure out what you can get the rights for. Because something a lot of people don't necessarily realize, if there's a potential rival, if there's a potential revival in the wings of something, it's not going to be done at a gala. unless it's a roundabout gala. That is the only time that happens, and that's because that's how Roundabout tests out full-length shows. Like how they did She Loves Me with Josh Radnor and Kelly O'Hara before they did She Loves Me with Laura Benanti and Zachary Levi. But they're kind of the only people these days who do that. If you're doing a production at the Philharmonic, chances are that means that there's not any plans for a full-scale revival in the next 5 years or so. And so I'm sure that's part of what put the kibosh on Forum, because there were, at the time, discussion of bringing Forum back to Broadway. It ended up falling through. But
and Company had just been revived on Broadway, the 2007 production directed by Jen Doyle and starring Raoul Esparza.
Which there is also a fair shot of.
Exactly what I was about to say, which was my first introduction to Company, was that production and seeing Raoul Esparza sing Being Alive at the 2007 Tony Awards and immediately going and buying my CD.
Oh, yeah. And I'm sure a big part of the discussion was also what show works in a concert context. Mm. You can do Follies in concert. Paul did do it, but Follies in concert is very different than Follies in full regalia. Company is kind of Company in both contexts because it almost verges on a concert staging normally. It's not really a show that lives and breathes on its set and costumes and technical effects. That's not what Company's about. It's about its wit. And you can do wit in a concert staging.
And the score as well. And something, after doing my research this week and rewatching all these productions, the various pro shots, was how successful the concert stagings are. I think they're better than full productions, because I found watching particularly the 95 Dunmar Warehouse production, it feels too busy. There's too much going on. It's distracting from the music and
one of the problems that revivals of Company have had across the decades is that people struggle with trusting the material, because they approach it being like, this is Company. And then if you actually take a look at the libretto, it's fairly thin. There's a lot of space for interpretation, and people get scared of that kind of freedom. And so they try to shove everything onto the stage. If you look at Hal Prince's original staging, it's basically like a modified, like, two-story jungle gym and a couple of moving tables and chairs and things. It's extremely simple. Again, the concept of negative space. And people sometimes have this inclination to Follies it. But where for Follies it works to put everything in the kitchen sink out there, Company is not a show that has that kind of scaffolding.
So bring us to the opening night of the gala in 2011.
Yes. So it's April 7th, 8th, and 9th. April 9th has both matinee and evening performances. So we've got four shows that are being taped to pull this together. We have an insane cast. Neil Patrick Harris is playing Robert. Patti LuPone is playing Joanne. This is the first time Patti plays Joanne in like a serious capacity. She'd sung Ladies Who Lunch before, but this is the first like serious doing the show. We have Martha Plimpton as Sarah, Anika Noni Rose as Marta, Dear Jim Walton as Larry, John Cryer as David, Craig Bierko as Peter, Katie Finneran as Amy, Christina Hendricks as April, Aaron Lazar as Paul, Jill Pace as Susan, Jennifer Laura Thompson as Jenny, Chrissy Whitehead as Kathy, and Stephen Colbert as Harry. It is a stacked cast.
And is it right that because of that starry cast, their schedules, they couldn't get everyone in the same rehearsal room until the dress rehearsal, which was being reviewed by critics?
Paul had to teach every single person all of their vocal lines separately, popping around to people's dressing rooms at other places. A lot of people were in other Broadway shows. Stephen Colbert, I believe, is in the early years of doing the Colbert Report.
Absolutely, yeah.
The number that was the hardest is the 10-minute long song Side by Side by Side, which is entire, like, you can kind of just teach one-on-one, like, Sorry Grateful. You can get through Stephen Colbert being taught this, and then you plug people in for the harmonies. Side by Side is an ensemble number in the most extreme version of that phrase. Everything had to be taught to each person completely separately, and the number was not run until the day of the concert. And Lonnie Price was convinced that it was going to fall apart the entire time, because he's like, if one person does a box step in the wrong direction, the entire thing falls. But this cast, they were all pros. Christina Hendricks and Stephen Colbert had never done a musical in this sort of context before. They'd done theater in like college and things like that, but they were not musical theater people in the way that like Katie Finneran is a musical theater person. And they fully plugged in and they just went for the ride. And it speaks to both the incredible talent of these performers, but also the steady leadership of this creative team, that no one felt unsafe and were willing to sort of jump in and try.
And on top of the starry cast, we have the New York Philharmonic, which glorious. And then we have the ensemble, which includes the vocal minority, Alexa Green, Fred Inkley, Rob Laurie, and Jessica Vosk. And then the ensemble, Callie Carter, Ariana DeBose, Sean Owing, Ashley Fitzgerald, Lauren Lataro, and Lee Wilkins.
Yes.
Crazy.
Crazy. And it's wild to me. This is actually Ariana DeBose's debut. So before this, she had been on So You Think You Could Dance. She was the first eliminated from her season. I still think she should have won on her save dance, but she was the first eliminated. And then when this happens in April, she had just done Bring It On. Bring It On had just opened in January of 2011. And if I'm remembering correctly, Bring It On is still running in April. So she took like a leave for a weekend to do this concert. And it's her first credit on IMDb. And dear listeners, we are recording this less than an hour before the Oscars. So hopefully we can tag this with Oscar winner Ariana DeBose, because she is incredible and a shining star.
When you think like what a career she's had in the past 11 years, that makes me very emotional.
Sometimes talent and good people win out.
Yeah, that's really, really awesome.
Another person in the ensemble that I'd love to shout out is Ashley Blair Fitzgerald, one of the other dancers, who is, in my opinion, one of the most talented dancers working on Broadway right now. She has my favorite dance sequence that I've seen choreographed for a musical in the 21st century. It's the Dark Lady sequence from Cher Show. And her work, I do not give mid-show standing ovations. It's a thing that I don't do. I find it. I don't like to like stand up and I make people stand up behind me to see what's going on. I just find it disruptive. The only times I've done it other than this situation were like closing nights, where I'm like, I'm going to stand up when she sings Journey to the Past and Anastasia. But like, everyone's standing up. That's why we're here. But I stood up the first time I saw Dark Lady as danced by Ashley Blair Fitzgerald, because the woman is incredible. Incredible. And so I have to shout out how incredibly talented she is.
Duly noted. So let's dive into the pro shot. We have Lonnie Price as the director. Paul Gemignani is the musical director.
Yes.
And Josh Rhodes provided the choreography. Costume design by Tracy Christensen, lighting design by Kirk Bookman, sound design by Peter Fitzgerald, hair and wig design by Paul Huntley, and makeup design by Angelina Avalone.
Yes. And one important thing to note, the person who's probably doing the most new work here is the choreographer, because we're using the original Jonathan Tunick orchestrations. Lonnie is obviously doing new work as a director, but he's not really changing like the script of what he's directing. It's completely re-choreographed for this context. It's not using any of the Michael Bennett steps, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, I agree. And so the pro shot opens with a really unusual image with the nine squares looking at the different camera angles.
Mm-hmm. Lonnie Price does a very... I feel like Lonnie Price is Hal Prince's vision of directing movie musicals realized. Hal couldn't quite engage. So Hal was really known as being a very cinematic theater director, but he was too theatrical for the camera, if that makes sense. It will make sense if you decide to sit down and watch the Little Night Music film. He couldn't quite make that leap where Lonnie Price can and has successfully many times. I think he's the best concert recorder we have in the musical theater right now. Also the best in many other ways, but specifically that. And it's so clever of him to start that way with the angles, because he's saying from the outset, hey, This isn't just a static camera in the back concert. We're filming this almost like it's a movie, and we're going to utilize close-ups, and we're going to utilize specific angles, and you're going to see things you couldn't necessarily see if you were sitting with the Philharmonic right now, and that's okay, because we're going to use this art form as an art form and not just an archival tool.
And I love the also the symbolism of it, that it's like little apartment squares, it's separate lives that create a whole. Like it's very beautiful in that way.
It is, yeah, it's poetic.
And I also love when we go to a shot of the stage, the squares on the back wall with the company letters from the original production, a nice little tip of the hat to the original production with the original logo.
Oh, yeah. Because Lonnie grew up on all of these. There's great interviews of him talking about like the first time Steve came to his apartment, and Steve like comes into his bedroom and sees the posters for all of the Sondheim Hal Prince shows. Lonnie, not only did he like do his homework, this is in his bones. This is in his blood. These shows are as much a part of his life as they are anyone who worked on the originals, in my opinion. Mm-hmm.
And that's why he's so good. That's why he's, and he's the other Sondheim musicals he's directed for film, the pro shots. Mm-hmm. It's like on the tip of my tongue. Sweeney Todd.
Yes.
And there's two Sweeney Todds, the 2001 Patti LuPone, George Hearn, and then the 2014, I want to say.
I'm not sure. Or thereabouts
with Bryn Terfel. Oh, and oh my gosh. Philip Quast is the judge, and I grew up watching Philip Quast in Australia, and I just adore him.
I truly believe that a production of Sweeney Todd rises and falls on the strength of its judge.
Yes. And the other ones, Lonnie Price has done, so he did Camelot also with the New York Philharmonic, and Candide and Sweeney Todd.
Yes. And he's done many concerts that weren't proper stagings.
Yeah. As a side note, he's so brilliant. Yes. okay. So what is interesting about this concert production is they cut the voicemails from the top of the show. Mm-hmm. It's a genuine surprise birthday party rather than being, I think other productions, it's like, is it a metaphorical surprise birthday party? It's not clear if it's a real life happening in real time.
Yeah, it's sort of in this hazy place.
Mm-hmm. And something that struck me watching it this time was when Neil Patrick Harris is blowing out the candles. Remember when it was like safe for us to blow all over a cake and then serve it and people would eat it?
Oh my gosh, yeah. I think about that every... So I've seen this company revival a handful of times now, and every time I see the revival, I'm just like, there's so much air that's being blown.
Post-pandemic, it makes one feel very uncomfortable.
We need to come up with a new cultural tradition that isn't blowing on food.
Yes. I've seen people have a separate cupcake for someone to blow out a candle. Cute. And that like that's their personal cupcake, and then we can slice up the cake. So I'm wondering maybe that is something the current revival of company needs to think about.
I mean, maybe. Technically, this is a spoiler for the way it's staged. Katrina like never actually gets like a proper blowout. Mm. It's always either trapped in her cheeks or the lights cut.
Oh, interesting. I don't remember that.
Like, the show ends and she leans forward, she does a wink and she goes to blow it out and the lights cut right before she goes.
Uh-huh. Interesting. I want to revisit it so much. Mm. And I, side note, I also want an all-female production of Company, please and thank you. Please. I know Sondheim didn't agree to it. He didn't agree to having lesbians in this current revival, which makes me furious.
We could do a whole podcast talking about it.
We could indeed. Okay, let's focus on the 2011 production. I keep getting distracted. There's so much to say. So what struck me about this opening number, the Company, is Neil Patrick Harris is this baby-faced Bobby, mm-hmm. who is very sweet and light, which is very different to other productions where Bobby has a more heaviness to him.
Oh, yeah. It's very – this is a Bobby who feels disconnected more than he does disenchanted. Disenchanted is the word I'd use for Raoul's Bobby. Mm-hmm. He's a Bobby who's, like, almost ready to give up sort of deal. It almost feels like Neil Patrick Harris's Bobby legitimately doesn't know what to wish for. Like he doesn't even know where to begin.
Yeah.
Versus feeling like he's at the end of the road, he doesn't even know how to start on it. He's too busy in that sort of flighty space, which I think is a really interesting interpretation for Bobby.
Yeah. And it keeps it lighter. It doesn't feel like this.
Oh, yeah. No, there is an existential crisis going on.
Yes. Yes. I really like that way of phrasing it. And I love the kind of, they remind me of airline seats, the little chairs that get wheeled around the stage.
The things that you have to do, because I don't know if people realize how shallow concert staging with the Philharmonic are. You have very little space, and so you just have to get really clever with how you move things around.
And they give this great sense of being a New York apartment, this like tiny, if you step one way, you've hit the wall, and if you turn around, you're basically at the other wall.
I would be surprised. I'm assuming that the New York Philharmonic probably had their props department on lock, but if someone turned their back, I'm sure there's someone in that company who would grab them and take them home to their apartment, because those chairs are perfect for New York living.
Questions must be asked.
Yes. Where are the chairs?
And I love the final photograph picture, the final pose at the end of Company, where it looks like a photograph, and I forget who it is. Who is it? Someone tall in the back, and they're looking like their eyes are closed in the picture.
I think it's Jim Walton.
That I think you're right, and that just kills me. It's such a funny little.
It's such a perfect little touch. Detail to throw in.
Yeah.
I love it's the specificity and detail that makes a production sing, in my opinion.
Absolutely. And why this production is so glorious, because there are those lots of little specific details. So after the opening number of Company, we go into a book scene between Sarah and Harry in their apartment, where we're doing karate.
Karate, which has been changed to jujitsu in the revival.
Mm-hmm.
Which is just an interesting random decision.
And I love the close-ups. It feels like TV, like shot like a sitcom, with the reaction shots between Sarah and Harry and Neil Patrick.
You've got Martha Plimpton and Stephen Colbert playing off each other, you bet it's going to start feeling like a sitcom, because they're some of the best comedic actors of their generation.
It's so brilliant. And it's so fun watching the ensemble and the orchestra enjoy their performances while they're performing.
I love watching Ariana just sitting and beaming in the corner. She's just having such a great time.
And that scene moves into the little things you do together, which is just fun.
Oh, yeah. No, and it's a song that immediately tells you what the evening's going to be like. If you're sort of not sure what Company is going to be up to that point, by the end of that song, you're either on board or you're never going to be on board.
Mm-hmm. And then that moves very seamlessly into Sorry Grateful.
One of the underappreciated Sondheim ballads from his canon. The older I get, the more I like it. And I think if I had to pull out like one song from Company that sums up sort of what Company is about at its core, I think Sorry Grateful is the one I'd pull out. I know everyone else would pull out Being Alive, but I think either Sorry Grateful or Marry Me a Little is actually sort of the thesis statement. It's either you take the good with the bad, or, well, there's a lot of interpretations that can be had with Marry Me a Little. But Sorry Grateful, it's just, there's something about it that is so honest. And especially when performed by Stephen Colbert, who is not a trained singer, so the only way he can communicate it is truthfully. He can't load it with bells and whistles. He just has to tell the story, and it really works.
Yeah, it's such an earnest performance, which is for people that know or have watched the Colbert show, what a different character that is for him and how beautifully it works. It's just so powerful. And also the orchestrations in that moment, the strings, just like when you have the New York Philharmonic string section giving it their all. It's just so, so beautiful. And again,
Paul's
the way it's shot.
Every single one of his tricks on this recording. He is there are like moments where he's fully showing off. And that is one of them, is when he brings in those violins on the, when Larry comes in with the good things get better, bad get worse. And there's just the sweep of it. It's like he's whipping a hurricane around. Mm-hmm. It feels very Tempest to me in the music of, it's just so rich and it just washes over you.
Mm. And the way that the camera frames that with a, I think it's the first time there's a side shot of Stephen mm-hmm. Colbert's face, and it brings us as the viewing audience, it brings us closer to him.
Yeah.
And it's so like it heightens that emotion, which is underscored by the music and the melody.
It's so good.
And then that brings, oh, I want to mention also, I'm obsessed with Stephen Colbert, the way he says wonder.
Yeah, wonder. It's very like, okay, wait, reminder of where you're from again. Got it.
Yeah. And also like just underscores that earnestness that he's playing with. Like it's just so, it's not like great singing technique, but it works so beautifully for him and that character. Mm. And that leads us into Peter and Susan's apartment, where the lighting shifts into this gorgeous, the projections of the New York apartments on the back scrim.
This is always like the vignette that has always been kind of like the weirdest for me to wrap my mind around, because for some reason, this is the one that every single time I've ever seen it, I take something different from the scene.
Hmm.
Like, everything that's happening with Sarah and Harry leads to Sorry, Grateful. The scene on the terrace, more complicated, but also not in an interesting way. And then every time I watch this pro shot, I come away thinking about something different, which I think is a really strong strength to the performers, that I can approach it from all these different angles and it still makes sense.
Mm. And it's interesting to me. I think it's the one that feels the most jarring going from, Drive a Person Crazy is the next, yes, it's after the next scene. There's no song for this scene. Yes. Yeah. But there's no song that follows
this. And they are the only couple that does not have a song in any like real way. Even so, hopping forward, like the Smoke Session couple, they don't like have a song, but like they sing pretty heavily in Poor Baby and sing things like that. Traditionally, the actress who plays, is Jenny the name? I always mm-hmm. lose track of the names in Company. Jenny is traditionally the actress who then sings the intro into Getting Married Today.
The soprano part.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Divorced Couple does not really sing except for like all hands ensemble numbers like Side by Side by Side.
And that I think it's Peter and Susan. And later, Peter has the scene where he comes onto Bobby.
Yes.
And that's kind of like, that's the culmination of that balcony.
Mm-hmm. Which it's very interesting that it's kept in this version, but in a lot of productions of Company, that coming onto Bobby is cut.
Again, all female version. It would be amazing when that happens. Please and thank you.
Yes, please.
So then we do go to David and Jenny, who are getting high.
Yes. Their dynamic is just, it just makes my heart happy. I don't know how anyone can look at John Cryer and Jennifer Laura Thompson and not be charmed. Specifically John Cryer trying to act high, trying to pretend he's a high person acting like they're not high is just so fun. But also, like, in a weird way, I find them to be, like, the most heartbreaking marriage in the show. Specifically the whole, like, the I married a square thing. Yes. Where it's like, he's opening up and you just immediately close it down again.
And my sense of David as a character is that he's not a very nice person. Mm-hmm. Like, he gaslights Jenny. No, you can't have another one. Yeah, you don't like it. She doesn't
aggressive.
Like it.
Mm. And the way that it just sort of takes him... Yeah, no, it's a whole thing. And it's an interesting color of when you swap it for the current revival where you've got Christopher Fitzgerald doing Jenny's lines as David.
Mm-hmm.
it's an interesting thing because there's a very different situation where it's a wife telling her husband, you need to chill out, to a husband being like, okay, you're having too much fun. You need to stop.
And I feel that way about Have I Got a Girl for You? It's such a bro-y energy. I don't think it works with women.
And Poor Baby.
Yeah.
Where the women are just like, you know, no one wants you to be happy more than I do. We'll get to Barcelona, but there's a lot of talk to have with that sequence.
Yes. They get high, and then we have Drive a Person Crazy.
Yes.
I'm obsessed with the orchestrations, the horns and the xylophone.
Oh my gosh, the xylophone, I love a good xylophone, and you never hear them in show tune scores anymore because there's just not space for them if you have a pit that's like a bunch of cubicles. Mm-hmm. But if you have like a full, use it because it is a color that is so fun, and it just, it gives me joy every time. I've seen several productions at Carnegie Hall recently that they've had stagings, and they've all used a xylophone in them, and I smile every single time.
Including the recent Anyone Can Whistle.
Yes, which Louisa was so good in.
We thank you. Featuring semi-chorus member Louisa Lyons. Woo! But the xylophone in that was out of control. Every rehearsal that we were with the orchestra.
I feel like it's impossible to be sad while listening to a xylophone. It's the sound of joy.
And the crowd goes wild after that number. There's so much energy in the room after Drive a Person Crazy. What do you think the wows, like in between each scene after mm-hmm. Bobby has had the interaction with each couple, he has like these, hoo boy, wow, like mm-hmm. what have I just witnessed kind of thing. What's your interpretation of those?
It's an interesting convention. Is what I think it is. Is I think it's a way to try and bridge all of these vignettes. Because that's really what the songs and the scenes are. Is there a series of vignettes that are strung together. And it's just, it's interesting to me how in this production they're like, you know how we're going to do it? Bobby's just going to be incredulous at the concept of marriage. And we're just going to maintain that energy. But yeah. It's something that, like, every production does it a little bit differently. In this one, it just kind of feels like Bobby is constantly, like, if he is himself 6 foot, and he's standing in the 6 foot line at the pool, and so he's, like, on his tiptoes to keep his head up, and he's just like, okay, we're not drowning yet, but, like, little in over my head at the moment.
And I like what you said before about this production being a musical comedy mm-hmm. production of Company, where Lonnie Price has used these, and Neil Patrick Harris have used these wows and these like little bits in between the scenes to invite the audience in. It's like
Bobby being able to comment on what's just happened. His reaction after the smoke session, very mm-hmm. different from his reactions after You Could Drive a Person Crazy.
Yeah.
Where, like, you're getting a little bit more to know of what's happening inside Bobby's head and his relationship to these friends through these little transitions.
Mm-hmm. And then we go into, there's this gorgeous, before we get to that, mm-hmm. we have I Got a Girl for You?
Yes.
Which I, as I just mentioned, like the bro-y energy of it and the playfulness of spinning.
It's Jonathan Tunick at his bounciest best.
Yes, with that low brass or doing the oom-pah-pah underneath. It's so delicious.
Truly.
And then that transitions. I don't know if it's a new orchestration for this production. I just don't remember it. Maybe because it's a full orchestra playing it. The transition into Someone Is Waiting is so, so beautiful. And like the way the double bass takes over from the brass is just, and the voices of the female ensemble doing oohs and ahs underneath. Like, it's just delicious.
That might be a new orchestration. Because if I remember correctly, Tunick is orchestrating this. So he's like adjusting it slightly, his original Company orchestration for this concert. At the same time, he had just finished orchestrating the 2011 Promises Revival. And that production, with Katie Finneran, by the way, is full of like the oohs and the ahs and the using the voice as an instrument. And so it would make sense to me if he's redoing that little section that he brings in those colors he's been playing with.
Oh, it's so beautiful. It works so well. And I love the lighting too. The like star-like circles on the screen. Good.
Someone is Waiting is a fantastic song.
Yes, it's so heartbreaking and so beautiful. And then that moves us into one of my favorite songs of all time.
Oh, yeah.
And the classic song, Another 100 People.
It's okay.
I am obsessed with Kathy and Bobby sitting in the chair with the popcorn and the soda.
Oh, yeah. So no, I think the dynamic between Kathy and Bobby in this pro shot is the best, like, dynamic Bobby has with any of the girlfriends in any of the pro shots. There is such an undeniable, like, weight to that entire scene. Not weight in like, oh, it's heavy and it's dragging, but weight of, like, every word they're saying is charged, and I feel like there is backstory behind every single phrase. It's so good. It's so good. And then to be whipped out of that scene into Anika Noni Rose belting her face off. So good. So good. Love every second of it.
Yes. I also love Anika Noni Rose's The Soul of New York monologue.
Oh, yes.
It's just delivered. And this production does so well. Every scene, like every word is important and every delivery. Like I feel like this is the definitive, this is how this is supposed to be.
Yeah, no, I think this is the definitive version of quote unquote traditional company.
Yeah. And speaking of Katie Finneran, next up we have Not Getting Married Today, also one of the most glorious songs ever written in the musical theater.
It's so good and it's so, so hard. It's so hard. And Katie makes a borderline definitive swing at this number where, like, it is a beast comedically. To me, still the perfect version is Madeline Kahn, but Katie is up there. Because you have to toe the line between being, like, neurotic and freaked out, but also they need to hear every word you're saying. You can't get too caught up in, like, the, I'm wheezing, and I'm, like, freaking out. It's like, no, you have to, like, there are so many jokes in those lyrics. Every single second, there's a new joke that's landing, and you need to try and at least land half of them.
And something I watch, rewatching the 95 production, the Dunmar Warehouse production, was the first time that I had a real sense of this song as a panic attack. I love Katie Finneran's, like, it is so hysterically funny, but it's in the musical theater world rather than the truthful world.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's not a criticism, it's brilliant.
It's so earnest, like when the moment where she's just like, I have to go after him. You feel like, okay, they're going to make it. Whereas there's certain times where I'm like, you're not having a panic attack. You actually don't want to marry this guy. And maybe you're making the wrong choice here. You don't feel like that in this verse. You feel like, oh no, Katie had a panic attack and now she's back on earth and she needs to move forward.
Yeah. And the moment in the middle, is it this scene where Neil Patrick Harris says, oh no, it's later, where he says, I never pay much attention to him, where he gestures at Paul Gemignami. Yeah. That's later. But she takes his baton and brings criminal sin.
It's so good. It's so good. And I love when Paul like does that sort of thing on projects he works on, because, and if you get the book, you will read about this. He does a lot of antics in the pit to keep people's spirits up. And I love when you get a little bit of a side of that part of who he is in these concerts. Because there's a ton of stuff. Like, the stories of him, like, sticking cough drops to his face and holding up signs for the cast to read. Like, he's a prankster. And you get a little taste of it in concerts like this. Because Lonnie intentionally makes sure they make it on camera. Because Lonnie was in Merrily We Roll Along and remembered watching Paul do this. It keeps the show fun.
You have just filled my heart with so much joy. That is just so delightful. I cannot wait to read your book. And B, that goes without saying. But yeah. I just, like, what a delightful touch that works so well in the film, but that brings out who he is as a person.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That is just.
Lonnie does it in all of the concert recordings. We could do a whole thing talking about Paul and Lonnie's relationship in various pro shots, because Lonnie really captures who Paul is in a very real way.
Okay, consider yourself booked for that episode.
Yes.
And then we have the final number. Oh, I just want to touch on the weight of the scene following Not Getting Married Today. We touched on it a little, but just how devastating it is after the heightened comedy of the song into the devastation. Face. Yes. Just so beautiful. It's and again,
that is the response. It's just
just how beautifully written the libretto, the book is of this show, that the scenes are just so tight and so rich in with so little words. It's just brilliant. And then we have the Act One finale, which it wasn't in the original production. When was this song added?
Marry Me a Little, it gets added in and out of productions. It was in the 90s that it started being consistently added in a serious way.
Was it written for the Donmar production?
I don't believe it was written for the Donmar production, but that's when it sort of debuted. Mm-hmm. I believe it had been in his trunk for a while before the Donmar. It's a fantastic song. People will bicker with placement or not. Like, do we need it? I think we need it just because it's a great song. And sometimes that's all that needs to be there to justify something.
And I think it closes, it brings us back to Bobby at the end of Act One instead of it being on...
closing on Amy.
On Amy, thank you. I was like, Katie, not Katie.
Name. Company is a show. I talk about people by actor names, not character names.
Yes. I think it's important that it closes on Bobby. And again, the camera work. Yes. It feels, I don't think it is crane shots, but it feels like crane shots the way they're zooming in from the dress circle.
It does feel like crane shots. I don't think it is crane shots, but I know they used, I believe, what's called the Bernstein, which is a camera that was installed to film Leonard Bernstein while he was conducting. And so it's a camera, there's like a hole in the back of the theater that faces at the orchestra. And so that's how you get some of those shots. But there's others that there, something must have been on a dolly somehow.
Yeah, or just the way it was edited, maybe. I don't know. But it's so beautiful because it's the first time that we have this zooming from the dress circle kind of angle. And the way it zooms down and in on Bobby is just so beautiful and so powerful for that gorgeous song. Okay, we're going to speed through Act Two because as we're recording, it is 10 minutes to the Oscars. Yeah. And I don't want it to be, because Margaret is in a hotel room to watch it. It's like a big deal. So we got to make sure we let you go.
Okay. So we talked a little bit about Side by Side and how that really, like, it comes together last minute, but it really does. It's a really treat. It's a treat. I really enjoy the way that it's staged in this version. What Would We Do Without You, to me, is basically an extension of Side by Side. I think of them as sister songs, so I'll include that in our little hop skip. Poor Baby, I'm kind of obsessed.
Before you get to Poor Baby, I want to talk about how the choreography highlights the orchestrations, and it's even more remarkable that it came together in such a short time.
Oh yeah, no, again, like, if anything had been out of step, it wouldn't have worked, but it all married perfectly.
Yeah. And when April comes into Bobby's apartment, this is the part where she's like, this is just darling. And this is just precious. And she's talking to Paul Germignani's back. And Neil Patrick Harris says, I never really looked at it.
It's like Paul's there, just like, thank you. And Paul loved Christina. Like, the whole group, it's a great group. And Christina's timing in this whole sequence, it's so wild to me that she plays April, because I feel like she's such a Kathy. But she pulls it off.
Oh, yeah.
Like, and she manages to make April not feel like a dumb blonde joke, which is what she can feel like in a lot of productions. Mm. She feels, like, smart in her own way, if that makes sense. And I really love how she does the whole butterfly monologue. It really works well.
She just exists on a different plane, so to speak.
she's in a different place.
Given that she's a flight attendant. She's literally on a different plane. Yes. I also love the touch of the mirror on the ceiling, the blocking of in other productions.
The way they lean into, in all of the interactions with Bobby and April, the way that they lean heavy into the idea of Bobby the confirmed bachelor is so funny to me. Like, we'll talk about, are you okay with me hopping toward TikTok for a second?
Yes, go. Let's go for our baby and TikTok.
Yeah, TikTok is like, this is my favorite version of TikTok. Is the version that is in this pro shot. I love the way they do the voiceovers, specifically the one where, so there's a bunch of them that are playing as they're doing this modified choreography that's paying tribute to the original, but it is new in and of itself. Kathy's dancing in the front, and you get this voiceover of Christina going, "I think I could love him." And it's immediately followed by Bobby going, "I wish I could remember her name." And, like, these are not things that are constantly, like, done in productions, these voiceover things. This is very specific to this production. And it's so, like, my heart drops out of my stomach every time. And I think it works so well with the dance, because the reason TikTok is cut so much regionally is people don't really know how to tell storytelling through dance in the same way. It's more difficult. It's a lot more esoteric. And when you add in these voiceovers, and specifically the close-up that they do on Kathy after she goes, "I love you," and Bobby goes, I, and they just, it holds on Kathy's, like you watch her world crumble, where it's not even like she wants him to say, "I love you" to her. That's not what this is. She wants him to be happy with April. She wants him to want something, and he just can't say it. And you, like, you get the whole story in their eyes. And again, I'm obsessed with the dynamic between Kathy and Bobby in this production. And TikTok is a highlight of it. Listeners, if you only watch one number from this pro shot, I think it should be "Poor Baby" through the end of TikTok.
That's interesting, because I always read it as Kathy wishing that she could be with Bobby, and that, like, what could have been is how I read it
that way. But the way that I look at it is sort of like, someone that you just so desperately want to wake up. And even if you're not the one who can wake them up, you just want them awake. And here he's given this chance, like, he say three words and you've done it. And he just can't get out two of them.
Yeah. He can't even remember her name. And then it moves into Barcelona.
Yes.
One which of the best is songs hysterical. Yes.
Christina holds her own.
The comedy is just so beautiful. Oh, yeah. And then we have another book scene with Peter and Susan back on the balcony, which to me feels uncomfortable now, because it feels a little homophobic, this idea that Bobby can't interact with Peter when he suggests that they sleep together.
I agree, and it's why I believe it's been cut from most productions. Of it does not play the way it should anymore. It played in a different way in 1971 because there's a very different social conditioning of what a homosexual relationship could be in 1971. In 2011, we're 4 years from Obergefell.
And in 2022, it's like, it's been cut. Am I remembering correctly? It's been cut.
Oh, yeah, no, it's completely cut in the current revival. Instead, it's a sequence where they're just like, "We got divorced in Reno, and also I'm pregnant. Divorce suits us."
Oh, that's right. I didn't like that in the she's pregnant.
Yeah, they're trying to find a way to give that scene a purpose without the whole homosexual scare thing.
Yeah. And then we have the glorious, my idol, my hero, Patti LuPone, as Joanne, singing "Ladies Who Lunch," not spraying her beverage across the front row.
And there's an interesting thing with Patti as Joanne, where, like, people like to harp on the fact that Elaine Stritch was playing Elaine Stritch, but, like, Patti LuPone is playing Patti LuPone, and it works. Like, it's a role that is perfect for a grande dame in that sort of context. And specifically, I love the way that she does the "another vodka stinger" in this version. It's so good. Because one of the things that's great about how much Patti LuPone has done this role now and sung this song, we can track the evolution of her interpretation of it. And I just really love that line specifically in this version.
And I love her delivery of the lines in the scene preceding it, especially when she's calling for another drink and the bartender puts it down without her noticing. So aggressive.
Yeah.
It just gets me every time. And all of the stuff about, "I've never left New York, I've never planned to leave New York, Chicago's somewhere over there." It speaks to me at a deep level. Even though I myself am a transplant to New York, I just get it.
Yeah, no, once you know where you're supposed to be, you should stay there.
Mm-hmm. So praise be to Patti LuPone and her epic performance.
Yes.
I'm so glad that that has been captured in in that way, because it's glorious. Mm-hmm. And then we have the penultimate number, Being Alive.
Yes, which was actually heavily reworked for this production.
In
Neil
what way?
And Paul really reimagined this sequence and sort of like what the beats are that they're trying to hit. Because Being Alive, in the way up to this point it had been traditionally staged, was kind of an energy of like someone who is dead. And instead they tried to find this energy of someone who has not yet begun to live.
Mm.
And try to find this sort of precipice energy. Rather, sort of like, instead of standing on a cliff's edge about to fall to your death, you're like standing at the bottom of a mountain getting ready to climb. It's sort of like the transition of energy of what they were trying to find. They were trying to make Being Alive feel triumphant in a way. Feel like a victory rather than like a shackle situation.
Mm. And I love the way that that's mirrored in the filming. There's very few close-ups in this number. It's a mm-hmm. lot of wide shots. And it's, of course, Neil Patrick Harris's performance is so moving and surprising.
It is, yeah.
I'm thinking back to like 2011 or 2012 when I first saw this,
and it was like your mother hype.
And he's still like, to me, he was Doogie Howser, and it's like, oh my god, the boy can sing.
It's like, what's happening?
And I love the final moment with Bobby sitting on the two-seater couch all alone, but he's happy.
I know, it's so good. It's like he finally is able to sit with himself. He's not hiding anymore.
Mm. Is beautiful.
Yeah. Company's a great show, guys. Surprise. Company's a really good show.
Any other thoughts that you'd like to share about this pro shot?
Highly recommend watching it more than once, because there's a lot of fun stuff happening in the background that is worth your attention. Mm-hmm. But also you should watch what's happening in the foreground, because that is also worth your attention. Just TikTok. People need to watch this version of TikTok, because it's so well done. And it makes the argument for why that scene needs to stop being cut in regional productions.
Mm-hmm. I love how it's been done. TikTok is done in the current revival.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's really clever.
The way that they turned it into a discussion of a biological clock is very smart for them to have done.
But also just imagining different futures was how I read it more than the biological clock.
It's the sudden presence of babies where there is no babies in the original TikTok is just very clear to me. I'm like, there's a lot of children that are running around here.
It's very clever. But this is a gorgeous pro shot. It of course inspired the Film Life Musicals website. It was released on DVD. I think it is no longer in print, if I'm remembering correctly.
It's not, but it shows up on eBay every once in a while.
Yeah. And although I don't like plugging bootlegs, it is available on YouTube. And
very easily on YouTube.
Given that we want people to watch things and enjoy them, if you do a search, it is available there.
Call your local PBS station and ask for them to re-release it.
Yes. Yes, campaign to re-release Company 2011. Yes. Well, Margaret, thank you so much for your expertise, for your time, for your passion. It has just been such a joy chatting with you, and I'm sure that we'll have you back again soon.
It's been so much fun. I've loved doing these, and I hope that everyone who's listening has had some fun getting to dig a little bit deeper on Stalentine.
And before we finish off, can you share where we can pre-purchase your book?
Basically everywhere books are sold. Your local indie bookstores, Barnes & Noble, all the way to Amazon, Bookshop, all that stuff. If you search Jim and Yanni, Life and Lessons from Broadway and Beyond, you will get about, I believe, 300 retail links.
Fabulous. And I will, if it's possible, I'll have links in the show notes and, links to Margaret's website.
If you ever want to keep up with anything that I'm doing, www.margaret-hall.com. I update it every week or so. It's got everything that's going on.
Fabulous. Thank you again so much, Margaret.
Thank you so much.
The Filmed Live Musicals podcast is created and edited by your host, Louisa Lyons, with thanks to our wonderful patrons, Josh Brandon, Geraldine Brewer, Belinda Broido, Elliot Charles, Gillian Dos Santos, Rachel Esteban, Mercedes Esteban Lyons, Rusty Fox, David Jones, James T. Lane, Alison Matthews, Al Monaco, David Negrin, Amy Penn, Gerald Piper, Jesse Rabinowitz and Brenda Goodman, David and Catherine Rabinowitz, Joe Tillotson, and Beck Twist for financially supporting the site. FilmedLiveMusicals.com is the most comprehensive list of film stage musicals. You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. If you would like early access to this very podcast, early access to site content, the full weekly newsletter with info on upcoming streams, and exclusive access to the streaming calendar, become a Filmed Live Musicals patron for as little as $3 a month. And if you're outside the US, you can sign up in your local currency. Visit FilmedLiveMusicals.com to learn more. If you like what you hear, please leave a review through the Rate This Podcast link in the show notes. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and thanks for listening.